Members, we're going to call the K-12 Education Finance Division to order. We have enough to for a call for, okay. Where's, is Representative Morrow around? He was here, there he is. So our first agenda item, members, is to hear House File 2426. Representative Morrow, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's nice to be back, and I hope I can encourage you to move the bill for me.
We don't have a quorum, Representative Morrow. When we get a quorum, I'll be glad to do that.
Great, thank you.
So we're going to hear your testimony and take any questions, and then once we get a quorum, we'll move the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, House File 2426 grows out of an experience I had this fall. I took my older daughter in for her first PSEO class buying books at Gustavus. There was one book, it was $185, but we didn't have to write a check because the book is provided as part of the PSEO program. As we were doing this, the manager of the Gustavus Adolphus bookstore came to me and was concerned. She had a worried look on her face. She said, "Terry, do you realize that we don't always get the books back and we can't do anything about it?" She says, "Not only as a bookstore manager, but as a taxpayer, I'm angry when students get books for free, don't return them, and then the state has to carry the dime." So this is a very simple bill that amends 124D09 subdivision 20. You'll see the language that the post-secondary institution may bill the student for textbooks and equipment that are not promptly returned by the student. That's the idea. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Morrow, there is a quorum, and so I will move that House File 2426 be laid over for inclusion of the Omnibus K-12 Finance Bill. And I have one question, Representative Morrow, I'd like to ask you. Last year, there was an amendment on the House floor, I think offered by Representative Westrom, I think, that has a very similar. Can you tell us, can you tell the committee, please, Representative Morrow, are there any differences between Representative Westrom's amendment and your House File 2426?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There was an amendment. There were two parts to the amendment. One was the part that I just talked about, and the other part dealt with reimbursement by the student of tuition for a course that wasn't completed. And I can't speak to why members would vote or not vote for an amendment. I don't recall the debate that well. But I do know that even when Representative Westrom offered the bill, I thought, hey, the textbook part makes sense to me. But I don't remember the whole debate. I think there were other issues involved. I can't really say much more than that.
Thank you, Representative Morrow. Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Morrow, is there any reason why the schools can't do this now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brown.
Representative Morrow.
As you look at the language that's in the bill before you, not looking at the part I'm trying to add in, what I heard, at least from the Gustavus bookstore, is that they weren't sure they had the right to do anything. That, yes, the student was required to return, the pupils required to return a textbook, but they didn't think they had any ability to actually charge them for it without explicit language in the statute.
Is it Bob? Follow?
No.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there anybody that knows the answer to the question whether they actually can charge them now or not? Is there?
Do we have anybody in the
Mr. Chair, Representative Brown, I think Representative Morrow made the case pretty well that there's some uncertainty. Part of that uncertainty is that for purposes of graduation, school districts are not allowed to charge students for materials needed for graduation. So, for example, in a high school setting, the school district can't charge the child for a book that's required for graduation. So I think it is a bit of an unclear area whether a charge could be made without statutory authority to do that, because our fee law in 123B37 prohibits certain fees, including the fees for textbooks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Morrow.
Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Morrow, we talked about this earlier, and generally I'm supportive of this, but I'm wondering who they return the textbooks to, because normally you buy a textbook from the school, and if you do return it back to the school office, you're only going to get a portion of what you paid for the book.
Representative Morrow?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Newton, what happens here at PSEO is the students go to the college bookstore, the textbook store, to get the book. The pupil doesn't put any money down. You just sign a piece of paper. Then you return the book at the end of the semester, and there's no charge as long as you return the book at the end of the semester. This is not a buyback situation where a bookstore pays a certain percentage for a book. And this is all done on the college campus. This is not done on the high school campus.
Representative Newton?
Mr. Chair, I understand that, but my point is that when they return the book, they're only going to get a portion, or the school district will only get a portion of the amount that was originally paid. You know, unless they hang on to the book and use it for another PSEO student the following year, hoping that they use the same textbook.
Representative Morrow?
I think you're probably right, Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you're probably right, Representative Newton. My only response to that would be, yes, the book may have less value at the end of the semester than the beginning, but a book that's not returned at all has zero value.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That leads to my question. Does this at all get into the area of normal wear and tear? What if the book comes back and tatters with the covers off? How do we address situations like that, Mr. Representative?
Representative Morrow?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Anderson, I'm always surprised what students seem to be able to do with textbooks in my own classes, use them as poster books, door stops, and the like. As long as the book is being returned, there's nothing in here, and there's no expectation about the quality of the return, as long as the books and materials are returned.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Morrow, I'm sure the students in your class would, they find your lecture so enlightening, they probably don't even need the textbook, so that's probably why they do other things with them. That was just an editorial comment. Representative Morrow, promptly returned. How are we defining promptly, and does that open up a lot of discretion that might provide some unintended consequences and difficulties for both students and schools, the word promptly?
Mm-hmm. Representative Morrow?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Demmer. I'm trying to leave this to the discretion of the bookstore. I'm not trying to say that the bookstore, A, has to do it. That's why I have the word may in, because the bookstore, I think each individual bookstore can make its own call. And I want to also give them some latitude, because some materials they may not even want to try to get returned. I try to leave promptly to at least let the high school students and the parents, myself, as I was explaining at the beginning of this, know that there's an expectation when the course is over, you got to get the book back, in part because every college campus makes book purchases looking 6 to 9 months in advance. So, for example, at the end of the fall semester, it wants to know how many books it has for the next fall semester of the same course. So if a high school PSEO student keeps the book until, say, May, then the college bookstore had to buy one more newer used book to replace it. So I'm trying to give the bookstores the latitude to figure out what is prompt that still meets its needs, and also to give notification to the families. If we find that there's an issue that bookstores are saying 24 hours or else or something, I'm happy to come back and work with members to amend the bill. But right now I'm trying to give some latitude.
Representative Detmer, excuse me, Representative Detmer.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know one policy I know our school has used, that the grades would not be given out to the student if the materials or if the books were not returned. They would withhold the grades. You ever thought of that solution?
Representative Morrow?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Demmer, I'm thinking of two different answers. I'm trying to put the college professor hat aside from them. But as a in terms of this legislation, I don't think as a college instructor I could withhold a grade because somebody didn't return a book that was part of the PSEO program. I think the grade's going to have to be submitted regardless. I don't know that we can hold a grade for a sanction. I think that it was either Mr. Strom or someone was talking about, we can't really either, I don't think directly or indirectly, put a fee in order to get your grade or in order to achieve graduation. I would have trouble with that, but I'm not an expert in what school districts can do within their school concerning textbooks. I'm dealing with the colleges and the high schools.
Representative Biskins. And the last question, it looks like Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to ask a question just so I could ask you, Representative Morrow, a question. But seriously, I'd like to know, how is it possible, none of my children ever went to a post-secondary school in which they did not have to end up buying the books in the first place. So to me, it seems only reasonable that if the college or institution is willing to lend bulk of equipment, they ought to have the decency to return them. So otherwise, it's kind of a theft, isn't it? So I don't know why you're having such trouble. No. It seems perfectly reasonable, your request.
Representative Morrow?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Benson. And my daughter did text me this morning. She said, make sure when you're in the committee, you tell them that I returned the book at the end of the summer.
One last question. Looks like Representative McFarland.
Mr. Chair, I apologize for coming in late, but...
You'll be fine later.
Where is this bill going?
It's going to be laid over.
Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering, I mean, this is something that affects higher education if they're the ones paying for the textbooks, and they would be the ones to be paid back. It just seems, I'm surprised it hadn't been in higher ed.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I might.
Representative Morrow?
I think there's some confusion, and maybe I should clear it up, or Mr. Strom could clear it up. The college isn't paying for the textbook. It's the K-12 system that's paying for the textbook. That's why the bookstore manager, Gustavus, was upset, not only as a bookstore manager, but as a taxpayer, saying we're sending out these textbooks at taxpayer expense, and they're not always coming back.
Thank you for clarifying that, Representative Morrow, again. All right, members, it appears we need no more questions, so I will remove my motion that House File 2426 be laid for possible inclusion in the Omnibus K-12 Finance Bill. Before I do that, is there any public testimony on this bill? Seeing no public testimony, then I will again renew my motion for HF 2426 to be laid over possible inclusion in the Omnibus K-12 Finance Bill. Thank you, Representative Moore.
Thank you, members.
Members, we didn't have a quorum to start with, and so Representative Anderson and myself, being the only two here on time, we took a vote, and it was 2-0. We're going to start a late fine fee starting today that is going towards Representative Garofalo's Girl Scout cookies. So we will pass that later. And actually, what I'm going to do is I'm looking for a motion to approve the minutes for Tuesday, March 9th,
Mr. Chair.
2010. Representative Squares.
Perhaps I'm misreading this, but underneath Representative Dabney's name, it says a quorum was not present, so evidently he holds a great deal of weight on this committee. So.
Thank you, Representative Swells, and so we need to address that, change that. Quorum is present.
They asked more questions about that Pidley bill than they will about.
Okay, Representative. When we started, the quorum was not present, and later, quorum was present at 2:52. If you read on further, Representative Swells.
All right.
Similar to today, as that's why we started the fine today. That's we're going to clear that up.
All right.
So. You're absolutely correct. So I'm just still looking to entertain a motion to approve the minutes for March 9th, 2010. Representative Morgan moves approval of the minutes for March 9th, 2010. Any further discussion? Hearing none. Those in favor say aye, please.
Aye.
Those opposed?
Aye.
Motion prevails and the minutes are approved. We'll move on to House File 3329. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 3329.
Representative Riley moves House File 3329 to recommend to be passed and return to the Finance Committee. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. These are this is a section of the governor's policy bill that those of you on education policy have already heard, and it just makes technical changes to the OPEB, other employee retirement benefits.
Members, any questions?
Post-employment benefits or whatever.
Members, any questions? No questions? How about any Representative Dempke?
Yes. Since this is now in the Finance Committee, do we have a target for...
Excuse me. Thank you very much. John, Mr. Benson. Representative Benson. I didn't get a lot of sleep last night.
So
are we going to have target numbers for that? I mean, has the department told you, Representative Greiling, when they're going to have target numbers for this particular bill?
Representative Gray?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Depke, you mean a fiscal note for this particular bill? We don't have a fiscal note. This came from the policy bill. So, when we get to the Finance Committee, any parts of the policy bill that do have fiscal implications, we will have fiscal numbers for them if we're looking at putting them in the bill.
Representative Depke? Okay.
Thank you.
Yes. Representative Anderson?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Notice the effective date is, taxes payable in 2010, and I believe first half taxes are due May 15th. What if this may not get passed until after May 15th?
Representative Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to have
Mr. Strom
answer that one.
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, this provision was offered as a technical amendment in the revisers bill that failed last May. Subsequent to that, the chair of this committee and the chair of the Senate committee sent a letter to the department suggesting this was how they wanted it administered. So the department has been administering the program as if these changes were in effect. So it shouldn't have any change on the property taxes payable that are coming up soon.
Members, any further questions? Representative Depke?
I'm sorry, I need to ask another one. I'm really not losing my mind here. If it has an impact on a maybe Mr. Strom, if you could answer this. If it has an impact on their levy authority, and we're going to be prorating that, so that they can levy for the additional funds, there will be a fiscal impact on it for the district, won't there?
Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Depke, the department, the general underlying language passed last year, but the technical changes that are in this bill failed as part of the revisers bill when that went down last spring. The changes that are in this bill are the way that the department has already administered the bill and probably will continue to administer the bill even if they don't pass, because there is some uncertainty as to which year it would apply to. But the intent is to make clear, essentially to clarify in statute the way the department is already administering this levy authority. So there shouldn't be any change whether it passes or not.
Representative Depke?
Thank you very much.
Members, any other questions? Representative Bradley, would you like to renew your motion, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I renew that House File 3329 be laid over for possible inclusion.
No.
Oh, no, I have to pass it.
Yes.
that it be passed.
So, Representative Bradley renews her motion that House File 3329 be recommended to pass and be returned to the Finance Committee. All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The bill is recommended to pass and be returned to Finance Committee. Representative Gryling, House File 3330.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I would move House File 3330. And members, this is to clarify definitions for special education excess cost aid.
So Representative Gryling moves that House File 3330 be recommended to pass and be returned to the Finance Committee as well. Representative Gryling, anything else that you want to add to that?
I think that covers it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions, members? Public testimony. Is there anybody who would like to testify on House File 3330? Representative Garofalo.
Just, Mr. Chairman, I just have a respectful request. Can we just get the mic a little bit farther away from you right now? It's you have a great voice, your great oration. It seems, and maybe it's just because I have a cold, but it seems exceptionally loud. So if there's any, respectfully, if you could just a couple.
So Representative Garofalo, I take that as a question. The answer is no. There it is, Representative Garofalo. Thank you sorry for that. This is my school voice. I'm sorry, my coaching and school teacher voice. And sorry to you folks as well.
No.
Are there any questions on House File 3330, Representative Beth Key?
I don't object to your voice at all. It is really keeping me awake. Thank you very much, Representative Moore.
All right. Anything else on House File 3330, members or public? Representative Gotti, would you like to renew your motion, please?
Mr. Chair, I do renew my motion for House File 3330 to pass to the Finance Committee.
So Representative Gotti renews her motion that House File 3330 be recommended to pass and return to the Finance Committee. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails and the bill is recommended to pass and return to Finance Committee. Representative Gryling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
3-3 on House File 3331.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would move that bill to be passed to the Finance Committee as well.
Representative Gryling moves that House File 3331 be recommended to pass and be returned to the Finance Committee. Any further testimony, Representative Gryling?
No, Mr. Chair, just that this, I think, is obvious as well, just removing obsolete language.
Members, any questions? Is there any public testimony on House File 3331? Representative Biskins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gryling, now is this one the compact, the mid-size, or the full-size luxury vehicle?
Representative Gryling.
Mr. Chair and Representative Biskins, I hope it's going to be full-size luxury Cadillac and any other superlative in the positive degree we could think of.
Okay, thank you.
Members, any other questions? Public testimony? Seeing none, Representative Gryling, would you please renew your motion for 3331?
Yes.
Sheila?
Yes.
Representative Gryling renews her motion that House File 3331 be recommended to pass and return to Finance Committee. All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. Motion prevails, and the bill is recommended to pass and return to Finance Committee. Members, we do not have the TRA pension bill in our possession, but we are going to have an informational hearing on that, on the TRA bill. So I would call forward Luther Thompson and Lori Hacking. And welcome to the committee, and as you testify, please state your name for the tape as you start your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Lori Hacking, TRA Executive Director, and with me is Luther Thompson, our Assistant Executive Director for Legal and Legislation. We appreciate this opportunity to give you a briefing on our financial status and this pending proposal. We're going to be working from this handout, which I believe was in your packets. By way of introduction, the Teachers Retirement Association is facing some very significant financial challenges. We are coming out of the steepest decline in our financial markets since the Great Depression. And that decline has had a very, very adverse effect on our funding situation. Our board, the TRA board, started about 8 to 9 months ago working on potential options and solutions to stabilize our fund for the future, both for our current retirees who are depending upon benefits and our active teachers who hope to collect benefits in the future. The board's proposals to stabilize the fund are embodied in this piece of legislation, Senate File 2573, House File 2952. TRA is not the only fund that's affected by this bill. MSRS, the State Retirement System, and PERA, the Public Employees Retirement Association, also have provisions in this bill to stabilize their funds. They're very similar provisions. They're not identical in all cases because our funding situations are somewhat different, but they are similar in that they attempt to stabilize our pension funds for the long haul. So we're here to brief you on the proposal, and even though it is the bill is not before you, as you said, we understand it has will have some implications for K through 12 finance. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Luther to start and the presentation.
Mr. Thompson, Chairman, welcome to the committee. Please state your name to for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Luther Thompson from TRA. I think I just have a few opening comments, and the first one I want you to remember, it's the market, and it's not Minneapolis, it's not the Post Fund, but it's the market. The second thing I would like to mention, that this is a measured, phased approach, taking into consideration the current economic conditions and the budget that the legislature is dealing with. Third, it's an actuarial necessity to fix the fund. If you don't fix the fund, it will be in default in 2032. The way the pension fund works is that we get contributions in and we invest those funds. And as you'll see by the chart there on page two, or it's page one, but it's the second slide, this fund works when the contributions come in early on in the life of the member so that the pension benefit is pre-funded, so that when the teacher then chooses to retire, the required reserves to fully fund that pension fund are there, and based upon the actuarial assumptions for their expected life and an 8.5% return, we will have adequate funding. The other thing is that pensions in Minnesota have a very large positive impact on the state's economy. The three large pension funds contribute over $2.5 billion annually to the state's economy. So it is a very large positive impact. It acts as a revenue stabilizer in times like this, and it actually acts as a positive revenue generator. We have a defined contribution plan as opposed to a defined benefit plan, and there is, we have a defined benefit plan, excuse me, as opposed to a defined contribution plan. And you'll see in your packet there a comparison of the two and why the one is cheaper, and particularly when you're using taxpayers' dollars. I don't think you want to risk those on in a plan where people may not have that pension when it comes time to retire. And lastly, I think it's the issue of the value of public education in the long term. These pensions do matter to your active teachers. They do act as a incentive for retaining qualified teachers. And sometimes I think we lose sight of the short-term budget considerations and not the long-term benefits of public education and the damage we would do if we didn't address these problems. The second page, slide number three, again, this demonstrates the first point that it's the market that's the problem. You know, obviously contributions were cut back in the 90s when we were fully funded. We did address the post-fund structural deficiencies, but those were about accounting deficiencies and not about who was responsible to pay. The actuarial assumption that TRA uses is 8.5%, and you'll see by the dramatic decline in the last year of a 18.8% loss, we are below that 8.5% when we look at the 5, 10, and 1 and 3 year averages. But up until that period of time, overall, we were exceeding that 8.5%, and since July 1 of 2009, we have experienced a return of about 15%. This all impacts on the financial status, and Lori will discuss that.
But yes, bottom of page two, I'm just going to go over the key indicators of our financial status, and I'm going to focus on the far right-hand column, which is our market value situation, which is a truer measure of where we are today. What you can see, excuse me, in the first row is our funding ratio is down to 60%. That literally means it's assets related to the liabilities that we are expecting. That's a very low funding ratio. It's the lowest we've been in over 25, 30 years, again, because of the very severe impact of the investment markets on us. That leaves us a deficit of over $9 billion. That's our unfunded accrued liabilities. And down at the bottom, the last row there, shows you our deficiency, that $9 billion or so, expressed as a percent of our payroll, which is 11% of pay. That is our deficiency. If you think about, we are collecting a little over 11% of payroll now, because teachers contribute 5.5% of pay, and the school districts match that at 5.5%. That's 11. You can see that our deficiency is huge compared to what we are taking in. It means we would almost have to, we would have to double contribution rates to take care of our deficiency if that's the only thing we did. But that is not what we're proposing. So if you turn the page, if we do nothing, we ask the actuary to project for us out into the future what would happen to our 60% funding ratio if nothing is done. No additional revenue or no benefit limitations. The purple line shows that our funding ratio would decline steadily and actually become exhausted by 2032. We ask the actuary to rerun those numbers using more optimistic investment assumptions just to see what the impact that would be of that. That's the green line, and that assumes that we'll earn 11% per year for the next 3 years and 9.5% on average thereafter. Those are pretty optimistic assumptions. We would like to achieve that, but I don't think we can reasonably rely on that. But even so, you can see that that line declines dramatically, and it really just pushes out our exhaustion date by a few years. So relying on investment returns alone can't get us out of the hole that we are in. So where do we go from here? As I said, our funding needs are large. Contributions would have to double to to take care of it. And we know that higher investment returns aren't going to be enough. So our board put together a package of recommendations that is really based on a philosophy of shared sacrifice, a balanced, measured approach to addressing the problem. We want to try to stabilize the fund in the near term and then hopefully bend that funding ratio line upward by the measures that we're proposing in the bill. We're not trying to solve this deficiency all at once because, quite frankly, that would be a very tall task, especially in our current fiscal environment, but rather taking an incremental approach to gradually but persistently address it. And we want to recognize that we are under a lot of fiscal constraints, the state as well as school districts. So there's no additional funds recommended or asked for in this proposal as it stands. So page 4, I'll go through the elements of our recommendation. Number one, we are asking our retirees for a fair sacrifice, a sizable sacrifice. We would be reducing the annual 2.5% benefit adjustment that they have had recently. That will be temporarily suspended for 2 years in January of 2011 and January 2012, and then brought back to a 2% level, which is lower than current law, until the fund is stabilized again at a 90% funding ratio. That is asking retirees for a significant sacrifice. We interacted quite extensively with our retirees during this whole process, and you'll see that REAM, the Retired Educators Association of Minnesota, has endorsed this proposal because they understand that it's in their interest to try to get the fund stabilized and better off in the future. Other benefit cuts that we are looking at that are smaller, there are things like reducing the interest rate we pay on refund of contributions from 6% to 4%, paying no interest on reemployed retiree accounts, and lastly, reduce the interest that we pay on deferred benefits to 2%, consistent with the retiree increases that we would be paying. Number 3 is employees. We're asking for higher contribution rates of 2%, which is sizable, but we are phasing that in gradually over 4 years in increments of 0.5% per year. Employers would be asked to do the same. This doesn't begin right away. It would begin July 1st of 2011. There's some lead time, not a huge amount, but some, and then it is phased in over 4 years. The contribution rates that we're asking on the employer side and to some extent the employee side, those rates are consistent with some of our historical norms. During the 1980s and 1990s, employer rates were as high as 8% and 9% during those years. And the employee rate used to be higher as well, up at 6.5% in the 1990s. So we hope this package will stabilize the fund, but we recognize a lot will depend upon what happens in the financial markets in the next few years, and we realize that we're going to have to reevaluate this in a few years to see whether additional measures will be needed or not. On page 8 is simply an accounting of all the savings and additional revenue that we are expecting. It all totals up to 7.15% of payroll, which compared to the 11% of payroll deficiency that we have is a really good sizable down payment. It takes care of about two-thirds of the problem. We are hoping that better investment returns will help us with the rest. But again, we will have to reevaluate in a few years to make sure that we are on track. Page 9 is a, or slide 9 is a, just a rundown of the initial impact on retirees, on active teachers, and on school districts. For retirees, you'd see we're using an average a monthly benefit of $2,300 a month. That is our average benefit and payment status now. So the freeze is going to hurt. It's about $57 a month or $690 annually in the first year. And then, of course, that's repeated in the second year of the freeze. You can see for active teachers using an average salary of $49,000 a year, which, again, is our average salary, the impact of the higher contributions in the first year is about $15 a month, $182 annually, and that's on an after-tax basis because our contributions are not taxable, so there's a beneficial tax treatment there. By the fourth year of the phase-in, the impact on teachers is obviously larger. It builds up to $56 monthly and $676 annually. Again, it's significant, but we believe, just as many have personally experienced because of the market downturn, we've tried to increase our savings and what's going into our retirement programs to make up for the investment losses. We think these are good investments for our teachers as well as retirees to make in our economic future. The impact on school districts in the first year is roughly $20 million. That, again, kicks in fiscal 2012. By the fourth year, of course, it increases, and it is in the range of $82 to $92 million. This depends upon what you assume to be the future growth rate in the total payrolls of school districts. In general, and this is just a very rough measure, This extra cost is about 1% or just under 1% of a typical school district's budget. So again, not small, but not huge and hopefully manageable for school districts. And I might add here, we do have the support of the School Boards Association and other groups like the Association of School Administrators who, again, recognize this is important for the operations of their school districts and their teachers. Slide 10 shows you that same chart again about that shows our exhaustion, but instead looks at what the impact of our proposal should be. The blue line is using normal economic assumptions of an 8.5% investment return per year, and you can see we do bend the line upward and aim toward a 76% funding ratio by the end of this period. And if we are can optimistically get better returns, we'd actually get closer to over 94% in the future. The next slide, I just wanted to point out, we've had questions of, well, why don't we wait and see? Let's delay taking action this year. And we want to demonstrate in this slide that it is very expensive to wait. The pink line or reddish line at the top shows you what happens to our deficiency if nothing is done. By the last year on that chart, 2015, our deficiency will have grown to over 16% of payroll, whereas if we go forward with this funding stability bill, that deficiency would be less than half of that. It would be 6.2% of payroll. The deficiency savings is shown in the green line, and really this is just a demonstration of the savings and potential revenue that we are foregoing if we did wait. And it mounts up to be very significant, nearly $400 million by the fifth year shown there. So page 12, I think Luther's going to speak to that.
Okay, Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, Luther Thompson. You know, sometimes people suggest that, you know, you can have benefit improvements or comparison with other states. But I think we're already where other states, you know, are moving. I think it's, you know, a political, economic, and actuarial fiction to think that you can have benefit improvements under the current economic conditions and the budget constraints. We need to focus on the financial integrity of the fund and mitigate the impact you know, certainly on the state's overall financial soundness. And if you look here, we are already, like I said, that where many states are going. They're cutting benefits. They're cutting the retirees' increases. They're increasing the normal retirement age. For our post-89 teachers, we have a normal retirement age of 66 already. You know, they're lowering the benefit tiers. And so when Laurie speaks about, you know, coming back here, if our package isn't sufficient, we clearly will be back here in 4 to 5 years, and we will be talking about a third tier, maybe hybrid plans, certainly significant, you know, more significant contribution increases to try to salvage this fund. We certainly, our primary focus is on trying to make sure that public education teachers do have a pension plan, and we reduce the turmoil and the turnover teachers in the public schools. If we go to the next slide, as Laurie suggested, this was a long-term process, started last summer, meeting with all of the interest groups, teachers, retirees, administrators. On the TRA board, there are 5 elected members. One is a retiree. 4 are active teachers. They unanimously supported this proposal. Of those 4 you know, elected members, they are members of Education Minnesota. They do recognize the need for this, and they are probably the most qualified of teachers to speak on this issue. As I've said before, it's an actuarial necessity to address this before default occurs. You see the support there of the retirees, the school boards association, the principals, the superintendents, the interfaculty organization, Rural Education Association, Committee of 13, which is the teacher organization in Minneapolis. So, I mean, I firmly believe, certainly retirees, teachers, and school districts get it. They know what needs to be done, and they're willing to sacrifice to get it done. We've discussed the economic benefits of pension there at the bottom of the page. I would just go now to page or slide 15. And what we have here is, this has been the TRA board position that was adopted last fall. And in there, they are sympathetic with this issue of the pre and post 89 equity issue, but it's simply unrealistic to address that in this term economic situation. And we think that certainly that might be something to be discussed depending upon what happens with this first phase of this stability plan. If in 4 to 5 years things are looking better, that's something, if people are willing to pay for it, they can discuss. But if things are looking worse, you're going to have more reductions, not less. So, I mean, comparing the formula multiplier for teachers, we think it's certainly adequate in the current economic situation. It's higher than St. Paul teachers, it's higher than Duluth teachers, it's higher than PARA, and it's higher than MSRS. So we think we have certainly a measured proposal here in terms of looking at the current economic conditions and the budget constraints. It's certainly balanced in terms of sharing the sacrifice between the retirees, the actives, and the school board, and it's phased in, and it comes with an amount of realism that we may be back here in 5 years with more severe reductions. But hopefully the opposite will be true, and we will have done the right thing now to save this fund. That's all I have.
Thank you.
There was one other thing I mentioned about the tax
Thompson.
Year. Mr. Chairman, there's also another handout in your packet, and usually when we come before you, it's unusual to have the support of the Minnesota Taxpayers Association, but on the back side of their handout, I think if you look there, they recognize that this general approach that all 3 funds are taking, they applaud this general approach, and they're probably as good as you can politically get. So I offer that as additional support with all the other vested groups.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Thompson, Ms. Hacking, I want to thank you for your hard work in putting together a proposal like this to guarantee returning some stability to this fund. The chart on page 5 of our handout, slide 10 of your the graph that you have there is particularly chilling for me, because 2032 would be right about the time I would plan to retire.
And the idea that right now I'm contributing 11% of my salary to a fund that would no longer be there when it's my turn to begin to access those funds, I find a bit troubling. So I certainly am one contributor to TRA who is willing to pay more so that this fund will be sustainable over the long term and that there will actually be some money there when it is my time to retire and access it. So thank you for your efforts. I appreciate your reasonable, sensible plan to provide some long-term stability to this this very important public employee pension fund. Thank you very much.
Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm on the other end of the spectrum. I'm a retired teacher, and I know that the same concerns that I'm sure the educators that are currently teaching have the same concerns. So it's something we need to deal with and deal with it early. Thank you.
Members, we have four more testifiers and anybody from the public that also wants to. So we'll take a couple more questions and we'll get to the other public to the testifiers that are signed up. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question on numbers on the slide 9 on page 5. If retirees' benefits are frozen for 2 years, why are those numbers not the same on 11, on 011 and 012? They're different.
Ms. Hacking.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, it's just the compounding effect of lowering the base. In the first year, since there is no COLA paid, the base stays the same as instead of rising by 2.5%. So when you calculate the loss in the second year, it's actually a lower base relative to what current law would provide. So that's why there's a slight difference. And in fact, that this chart doesn't show it, but if you take that out many years, you would see that same sort of compounding effect of having a lower base that the future increases are being calculated on.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. Let's say everything turns up roses and the economy really does do well and the market goes up. Would you be back here before 5 years and visit with us with more pleasant recommendation, possibly?
Ms. Hacking?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, it's a very good question. Actually, in the bill, there's some built-in, shall we say, triggers. If we do, on the retiree side, if we do get back to financial health, those increases of 2.5% per year would be restored. So that, in a sense, happens automatically if the fund gets back to 90% or higher. On the contribution side, where we've seen contributions increase for school districts and employees, there's also another sort of stabilizer mechanism in there that should we get back to a sufficiency position, get back to 100% funded sooner than we were expecting because of great financial returns, those contribution rates can be actually increased. And I should explain that there's also the opposite could happen if we continue to be in a hole, that then those contributions can be moderately in small increments increased from year to year. So there are stabilizers in the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Thompson, I know you mentioned something about St. Paul and Duluth. What might happen if the same thing that happened when Minneapolis came into the TRA, if Duluth or St. Paul would come to TRA? What's the prognosis there?
Mr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Demmer, it's hard to say what would happen. I mean, clearly, if they end up in the same situation, unless something is done and some funding is found, they will face default. Clearly, the issue about what would happen to them, whether they would get consolidated or not, would have to be addressed by the legislature. And certainly you'd have to have funding. When we consolidated with Minneapolis teachers, we were in a much different position. We were fully funded, and we did get additional state money to finance that. So that's a question that sort of comes up, but I don't think anybody at this point has seriously talked about consolidation.
Representative Manziel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, too, very much appreciate your work. My question has to do with slide 9. impact on retirees. I assume that pertains to people who are drawing, people who are in either year one or year 25 of drawing these great benefits. Why do you treat a retiree the same in terms of the reduction in benefits, whether the retiree is in year 2 or year 22?
Mr. Thompson, Ms. Hacking, whoever? Ms. Hacking?
Mr. Chair, Representative, basically it's just to be even-handed. There were ways we could split apart the retirees. Let's say some retirees who retired prior to 2000 got larger increases than those who retired subsequently. But it becomes a little difficult to defend as to why you're segregating and how to differentiate among retirees. And quite frankly, when you try to differentiate, then you start losing the savings that we were trying to get to help stabilize the system. So our board did actively consider some other options and in the end felt that this more even-handed approach would be best. We also got that same feedback from our retirees. The retiree organization said to us, we, for example, prefer a freeze because we want to get this over with and get the fund stabilized as quickly as possible and be able to resume our increases. And they also gave us feedback that they didn't want us to really segregate among the retiree segments for different treatment. So we sort of honored that.
Mr. Thompson?
I would just add one thing. It would be like comparing apples and oranges. If you were to compare a retiree today with a retiree in 1999, because the COLA is just one of those things. That happened to that retiree in 99. You can't just factor out that and say, well, we should treat the new retiree differently because new retirees were active teachers and we don't know what they experienced during those years in terms of salary increases or other forms of compensation. So what you want to do is treat all of the retirees the same in any one given year because it's trying to adjust for the COLA or some cost of living in that year. What happened the year before or 2 years before, you can only compare like retirees or those that are in the same cohort group.
Representative Menzel?
Thank you for the explanation. I would suggest, however, that while I certainly understand the incredible complexity of all of this, it just seems to me that as we move into this proposal, support among retirees will begin to drop off once retirees, different cohorts, go back into their employment history and look at salaries and look at changes in TRA policies and benefits and discover that the uniform approach might be advantageous for some and not a good thing for others. And I just caution that I don't want to see groups flake off of from the proposal. So good luck.
Members, we have one more question, then we're going to call down three testifiers that are coming down in support of, I think, and then we'll leave the separate one after that. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this may be, I see Ms. Alsweiger wants to come down and speak, but one of my concerns is even though you say it's only 1% of the budget for the school districts in our particular school district in District 11, we would be hit for roughly $4 million, and every $1 million is roughly 20 teachers. And we're going to be laying off more teachers. So is that somehow factored in that, you know, with the $82 million you've got somewhere, probably in the neighborhood of 1,200 teachers that would be cut statewide, are you factoring that in as well? Because you're going to have less people paying into the system And I must add that I'm somewhat surprised that MSBA has gone along with this. Thank you.
We'll hear from them in a minute. And Ms. Hacking?
Mr. Chair, yes, we do, our actuaries do look at how our total payroll growth fares each year. And so we are cognizant that this could have not just this, but the whole economic climate that we're in could have some negative financial impacts on our payroll growth base. And that's just something we will watch and have watched. And that's all we can do.
We'll call down now Mr. Stanton and Mr. Kite and Ms. Kelleher. If the three of those can come down together. Mr. Stanton, Mr. Kite, Ms. Kelleher, or a representative from IFO, MASA, or MSBA. And as you start your testimony, please identify yourself for the tape. And Mr. Stanton, why don't you go ahead and start, huh?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Russ Stanton. I'm Director of Government Relations for the Interfaculty Organization. That's the union for the faculty, about 3,800 faculty at the seven state universities. I don't normally testify before a K-12 committee here, but whatever happens to TRA affects our TRA, hundreds of TRA members and thousands of TRA retirees the same way as affects K-12. The Interfaculty Organization strongly supports the TRA financial stabilization legislation. First of all, we support raising both the employer and the employee contributions by 2% phased in over 4 years. That by no means is an easy position to take. Our members got zero and zero. 85% of them at least for the next 2 years. Given the budget deficits, we're probably looking at flat increases for some time in the future. So this is going to be taken out of flat checks. But we do support the TRA proposal because TRA is in very bad shape financially. TRA, as was mentioned, has a $9.2 billion deficit, our unfunded liability at the present time based on market value. And even if you take the more optimistic figure, the five-year smoothing valuation of the assets, it's still $5.1 billion with a B shortfall, and that's a shockingly large unfunded liability. And it would take an employer and an employee contribution of 16.57% of salary from now until the year 2037 to get the fund back up to full funding. Please do not fall for the illusion that the market is going to pull you out of this situation that you're in. The stock market was only one of the causes of this unfunded liability. I think we need to be honest. A large part of this problem was caused by a flawed post-retirement cost of living adjustment that was in place back in the 1990s. And we had years where retirees got 9, 10, and 11% annual cost of living adjustments when the real CPI was only 2%. And it was also caused by the fact that during those good years, the asset values were rising so fast that the employer and employee rates got cut in the 1990s, and that simply has caught up with us now. There's not much you can do about that problem. That's water over the dam. You can only fix things going forward. If you don't address this problem, even given an optimistic 8.5% cost of, rate of return on the investments of TRA's investments, for the next 22 years, TRA will still run out of money by 2032. And the longer you postpone it, it very sharply increases the contributions necessary to solve it. And I guess our great fear is that if it goes very much longer, the contributions that will be required to solve this problem will be so large that you won't be able to solve the problem. You won't be able to raise taxes enough, and you won't be able to raise the contributions enough, and the fund could fail. TRA benefits were a promise that were made to employees when they were hired. Many employees worked, I mean, they paid for half of it with their own contributions. Many employees work 30 years or more based on the promise of that pension benefit. It's their primary source of living, primary source of support for one-fourth to one-third of their life when they retire. If you allow the fund to fail, you're going to have a situation where it's going to be very, very difficult to recruit people into the teaching profession in Minnesota. I think it's something that we just cannot afford to see happen. IFO also supports suspending the annual cost of living adjustment for retirees for 2 years. The last 2 years, TRA retirees got 2.5% cost of living adjustment or annual increase each year. In 2008, the real cost of living was actually negative 0.34%. Last year, the real cost of the CPI was 1% that it went up. So even if you suspended the cost of living adjustment for 2 years, you're basically just bringing people the benefit increases for retirees back in line with what real cost of living adjustments have been. Also, by suspending the cost of living adjustment for 2 years, you provide a mechanism that those retirees who back in the 90s got 9, 10, and 11% cost of living adjustments can pay for part of the solution or share in some of the pain of solving this problem. IFO opposes any benefit increases until the fund is back in good financial shape. The fund, as I said, is in horrible shape, $5.1 billion. Even if you take the smaller number of evaluation, we shouldn't drive it further in the hole by granting benefit increases that you simply cannot afford to pay. The post-1989 teachers do not get as good of benefits as those who retired, who started before 1989. I fully recognize that.
Mr. Stanton, you want to make sure we get everybody an opportunity? Sure. Are you pretty close?
I'll wrap up here.
Thank you.
We want to make sure that those post-89 people, if the funds recover, are first in line to be taken care of. But right now, we simply can't afford it. So we realize this is a very tough decision, but I know that I've talked to our members about it, and their priority is stabilization of the fund. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Keller, maybe you can address also Representative Newton's question about MSBA being on board here. So welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and give your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Grace Kelleher with the Minnesota School Boards Association. We are here to support this proposal in front of you. This was not an easy decision for either my board of directors or my membership to go forward with. They wrestled very hard with this. What really appealed to us was the combined sacrifice. You see the employer, the employee, and the retirees facing this deficit going forward. My boss's favorite saying is you can only spend a dollar once, and my members wrestled with that, as Representative Newton inferred. And in fact, they felt that this is a commitment that school boards make to their employees, a one-on-one deal, and we need to restore the foundation of this fund before we go forward. We are not in favor of any benefit increase. But once again, honor the commitment we've made to all our present teachers and all our former teachers, and hopefully all our future teachers going forward. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Keller. Mr. Kite.
Chairman Ward and members of the committee, I'm Charlie Kite. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. I report to you that my colleague, Ms. Alschwager, offered to come down and testify for me, but and I almost took her up on it. In the interest of time, I'll just simply say this, because the testimony of these last two people are very strong. We support this bill. Secondly, we think it's a reasonable solution, and we would like to see no changes in the bill in terms of benefit increases. At the same time as we say that, we also recognize that somewhere down the road we're going to have to wrestle with a couple of those issues for post-89 employees. And we pledge that we'll be here at this table trying to find a solution for that when the time comes. But right now, let's get the funds stabilized first and leave it at that. Thank you.
Very good, Mr. Guy. Thank you. Regis Wells, was your question with one of these two testifiers?
No.
Okay, can we go on then? And just so we know, in the public here, is there anybody? We're going to call down Ms. Allswager. And then anybody else in the public wish to testify on this? Give testimony on this? Okay. Ms. Allswager, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jan Allswager, Education Minnesota. And I must say that we agree with many of the comments that the other testifiers made and that we do want a stable fund. It does need to be fixed soon. In fact, we have been pushing this issue for a number of years. If you'll recall, a couple of years ago, we pushed it hard. Had we done it then, we would have been a little farther forward than we are right now. We have two legislative priorities. One, a stable fund, TRA. Now, I'm only talking about the TRA fund. I'm not talking about St. Paul and Duluth. This is a TRA proposal, even though we do represent those teachers and we want them to have a good pension fund, too. We want a stable fund, and we would like pension benefit equity. I need to provide you with some history, because our big concern is the term shared sacrifice, and that the solution that is being put forward is a 2% increase on active members and a 2% increase on employers. I see that you're looking at the documents, so I'll go right to the documents. To give you some perspective, take a look at this legal size document. This compares Minnesota teachers with the other total 34 states that you can compare them with because they're coordinated with Social Security. There are about eight columns, and those columns tell you the factors, give you information about the factors about how good their pension plan is. You want to be, excuse me, I have the wrong side, you want to be, if you the better pension that you have, you want to be on the front side on the top. And if you look at that document on the front, you will see that Minnesota teachers are only above average in one area. And what is that area? Employee contributions. That's the only area where they are above average when compared to 34 states. And in terms of for the employee, that is not, you don't want to be on the high side. You'd rather be on the low side on that category. Now flip it over. Now we're looking at the very bottom of all the 34 states. And normal retirement age, we are in last place. For those who don't have the rule of 90, you see two graphs there because those who have the rule of 90 are up higher and those who don't are lower. Employee contributions, we're already above average, so we're on the other side. Employer contributions, we're near the bottom. Final average salary, we are tied for last place. Formula multiplier. Now, this was produced in October of 2006, so we have moved up to 1.9. We would be right now at the top of the backside. Pension calculation after 30 years, we're near the bottom. Taxation of benefits, we're one of the very few states that tax at the 100% rate of the retirement annuity. So when you talk about shared sacrifice, I want you to think about this. Now, let's go to another document. This is a document produced by TRA. And this document on the left side shows the history in graph form of the TRA contributions. TRA and Education Minnesota worked side by side every year prior to this year because we wanted to fix this fund. And this document, this graph is produced to show you that in times previous to 1997, the employer contribution was higher. When the fund was less stable or needed some stability, the employer fund increased, contribution increased. In 1997, it was decreased significantly from 8.16 to 5.0. Had that been maintained, we would be at a totally different situation today. But think about this. You, some of you have 403Bs, 401Ks. When you contribute or your employer contributes into your 401K, when it's doing really well, you don't stop contributing. And you don't stop contributing because, or you don't reduce your contribution because you want to make sure that fund is growing. Because there could be bad times ahead. But in Minnesota in 1997, because there was a sufficiency, the employer contribution was reduced. There was a common understanding that if the fund was having trouble in the future, today, that the employer would step up and put some more money in. So the employees sacrificed a number of years ago and said, okay, we'll go take it down to 5.0%. And now look at what is happening. The state, we believe, is backing away from the obligation to fund the employer portion. Take a look at the green vertical graphs on the right side. The average employee contribution is a dark green, which is 5.0% across the country. Minnesota is 5.5. Again, we are above average. But take a look at the employer contribution. On average is 8.6%. And where is Minnesota? 5.5%. So when we talk about a shared sacrifice, we would say that the actives in Minnesota would be asked to pay more than what you would see on average across the country, and the employer, it would be paying less. Take a look at the third document that I have provided to you. It's the historical contribution rates and funding ratio, again another document from TRA. The funding ratio is on the far right, and you can look down near the bottom. In 1997, the contribution rate was, the funding ratio was 101.3. Now, hindsight being 2020, you could say, well, we probably shouldn't have reduced that employer portion, the contribution, because we would be in better shape had we not done that. And now we're certainly at a lower funding ratio, and we would have been better off had we left that in. 2 years ago, the merger of the post fund and the active fund passed. If there was a trigger where the post fund went to 85% for 2 years or 80% for 1 year, it only took 1 year, and the post fund went to 79.9%. And we told you very loudly, very clearly, very strong, we said, please do not merge, don't pass this bill. Because if the market does go down, we will be here saying the actives should not pay for this because it was not caused by the actives. The actives certainly should be responsible for a portion of the market that has been lowered that they can attribute to. Mr. Thompson said earlier that that you might hear that it's three-fourths of it is due to the post fund. He said that's not true. I will read, quote, from a TRA document, a PowerPoint produced. How did we get here is the title. Severe market downturns in 2000s and list them. Extra investments returns in 1990s not retained in the TRA fund. That is what Mr. Stanton talked about. I wasn't going to bring that up, but since it's already out there, retirees received 9, 10, 11%. That was a burden on the post fund. It helped to create a deficiency. And then this is the statement that I would correct. Because on this document from TRA, it says large increases in retiree annual increases, 9.7%, da, 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 da. And then it says three-fourths of current unfunded liability is due to post fund. Over 60% of TRA liabilities are for retirees. So I don't know why that statement was made earlier. We want retirees to have their pension benefits secure. I am not saying anything contrary to that statement. The only point that I am trying to make is that our active members should not bear the burden that they did not create. Our active members, there are 70% that do not have the rule of 90. If you ask them to pay for a 2% contribution increase, You are asking them to pay for the benefits that those received that they will not get. You're paying for the rule of 90 for those that don't have it or the previous benefits that others received. Education Minnesota went to the Pension Commission last week, and we said we have a solution. We should fix the stability and the pension benefit issue. And we are willing to have a 3% increase on the employees. It would take us to almost the very top of the employee contribution in the states in the graph that I shared with you. Why? Because we want a stable fund and because we want the pension benefit equity. If we did that, we would pay 100% of the pension benefit improvement and 1% for the deficiency. And the employer would pay 3%. Right now in the bill, it's 2%. It's 2 and 2. We would say 2 for improved benefit, 1% for the deficiency, 3% on the employer side for the deficiency. That would take care of the problem. Education Minnesota would support it. We are behind trying to find a workable solution. And I would be more than happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. Representative Swales, you have been waiting, and then Representative Ruffo as well, or other members that have jumped in here. Go ahead, Representative Swales.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Alschweiger, you know that I have been a strong supporter of EdMIN. I'm a member of EdMIN. I do feel a little bit disappointed in my union in some ways over the last couple of weeks, and part of it is just some of the stands that I've seen Mr. Dewar taking and other things. Right now in your testimony, even though you do offer a solution, I do feel like there's a lot of finger pointing at decisions that were made in the past, and that doesn't rectify the situation that we're in right now. Nor does it look to the future where in the next biennium we could have as much as a $5 billion deficit facing the state. I'm a little bit disappointed that you keep talking about the employer, because school districts are public institutions. They are funded by taxpayer dollars. So the employer here, is it the school district? Is it the property taxpayers? Is it the school district organization? Is it the superintendent? Is it the school board? But I again feel like you need to be more precise in what you're stating who the employer is, because in my community, the taxpayers are the one that pretty much determine if levies get passed, if we get referendums, if we get any cost of living increases at all. I've not had one in 3 years as a teacher. But I do look at the list of organizations that have worked on this proposal, and I feel that there has been tremendous discussion around this issue, and it troubles me that EdMIN is being very adversarial to the work of these other groups. And I am a proud member of EdMIN. But I did not become a teacher to get rich. I did become a teacher because Mrs. Sutterfield in seventh grade wrote a sentence on the board and then put it in a diagram, and I became infatuated with grammar, and I love it. I did not become a teacher thinking, I'm going to make a lot of money. But throughout the almost 30 years of teaching that I have had in the classroom, I have had the assurance that because I chose a profession where I'll never be rich, at least I will have some security as I grow gray and wrinkled and old. And I'm already getting there. But I think for a two-year solution, what the TRA people have brought to us is reasonable. I don't feel that what you are proposing makes sense, to be real honest. I really would like to see a little bit more acquiescence on the part of EdMIN instead of a fist at every turn. So you can comment to that, but right now I'm just speaking out of my frustration.
Ms. Osweiler?
Mr. Chair and Representative Swales, we are more than happy to sit down with anybody who has an idea to figure this issue out. I think one of the things that we could talk about is TRA uses the 4.5% salary assumption growth. Well, Representative Swales said she's getting 0%. That has, you know, that would change the figures. If we're assuming that everybody's getting a 4.5% salary increase, we know that that's not happening. The returns have been 15% since June 30th. We're not saying, I'm not here predicting what markets are going to do. I wouldn't do that. But we are more than willing, Representative Swales, or anybody in the legislature, we're willing to talk about a solution that we think might be more fair to our active members.
We have two more members with questions. Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, do you want to finish at 4:15, or are we going to be going a little bit late today?
I would like to finish at 4:15, but what's the committee members?
Okay, Mr. Thompson, I just have a couple technical questions. I'll just state my opinion. That's why I have very quick questions for him. I just, I'm going to support this bill when it goes forward. It is very difficult for me to support this. But Ms. Salzweger, if you could just please deliver a message to your state board. It's not a message delivered at you. It's to the state board for your organization. It is very hard for people like me to vote for a bill like this. Okay, this is a bailout. That's what this bill is. And I am stating my support that I'm going to vote for it. So when I hear testimony, I get very upset. I'm going to keep it throttled down today. I'm going to keep it calm. It's not you. You're delivering a message. But there are my constituents, the taxpayers I represent, would love to have a deal like this for what happened to their 401ks. They would love it if they could have that opportunity. And I just wanted to state that. But again, I'll be supporting this bill. I hope as the bill goes forward that it moves forward early in the process, that doesn't get bottlenecked until May 16th. That's kind of our history on pension bills. And I hope it doesn't get thrown into an omnibus bill, that it passes early. I've stated I will support this, and I'll stand by that word. Mr. Thompson, just a quick question. The CPI indicators that we are using in the pension, can you please just, again, you've answered this for me privately, but I think it's important for members of the committee to understand, just to explain how the CPI increases have been occurring in the past, and why this is so beneficial to do it so early now, the benefits of it in the long run, the power of compounding interest.
Mr. Thompson.
Mr. Chairman.
Garofalo.
Mr. Garofalo. what happens is, you think about, we've got a bucket of money here, and what we're trying to do, there's two things you can do to increase the value. Certainly the market over time could increase it, but you got to stop the outflow, and you got to increase the inflow. And the outflow is directly going to retirees, and that, unfortunately, is fixed at 2.5 by statute. I mean, it used to be up to 3.5, and then they had the investment component. That was fixed by statute. We tried to change that in the 90s, and of course, nobody wanted to change it. I guess I'd like to correct a couple things. One is, this issue about on the front page of this where it says we're at the top and that's bad. I would just like you to look at the scale on the employee contributions. At the top of this, it's good, because at the top of it is zero. So you want to be, the closer you are to the top, the lower your contributions are. So that's a good thing for teachers, not a bad thing.
Exactly.
The other issue deals with the post fund. Now, clearly there were issues with the post fund, and TRA is heavily loaded towards retirees because we have long service employees. Now, whatever that percentage is, when the post fund was terminated by legislation, it was based upon a recommendation of the legislative auditor that the way it was accounted for in the past was not transparent. It had nothing to do with who is responsible for any loss in the market, whether you're a retiree or an active. That's not an issue that's related to the post fund whatsoever. I mean, this is simply an issue about where do you normally get the money from? You get it from contributions, whether it's on the employer side or the employee side. Any other questions?
No, that's it. Thank you.
Representative Marquardt? Kate, thank you. Any other questions, members? Okay, members, we're adjourned.